You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is The Last Outpost. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
The synopsis for tonight's show is, in pursuit of Ferengi marauders, the Enterprise and its quarry become trapped in a mysterious planet that is draining both ships' energies. First aired on October 19th, 1987, it was written by Richard Kurzmeen, K-R-Z-E-M-E-M-I-E-N, I hate names, directed by Richard Kolla, K-O-L-L-A. Guest stars tonight include Armin Shimerman as Litek, Jake Dengel as Mardok, Tracy Walter as Kairon, Mike Gomez as Daemon Tar, and Daryl Henriquez as the portal, the sleeping portal. Oh, I hate names. Okay, so what do we think about this episode? Yeah, it's a little silly. We'll talk about it later, but this is our first taste of the Ferengi and our last taste of the Ferengi as they are in this episode, if that makes any sense. What about you, James?
Well, actually, I think that in the past, I've always considered this episode to be, yes, rather silly, and it does misfire, I suppose, from the perspective of the Ferengi. But actually, rewatching, I actually felt that it falls into two halves, actually. And we'll go on to the more detailed observations later. I actually think that the first half, the setup of the show, is pretty well executed. And just unfortunately, it falls flat as we approach the end and as the situation is sorted out towards the end of the show with, in particular, with Porto and the meeting on the planet with the Ferengi is somewhat painful.
Okay. All right, and before we get into the show, let's go ahead and do a little feedback of part two from Encounter at Farce Point. And before we get to the feedback, here's one that I should have included in this episode but forgot to. This is coming from Mike, otherwise known as Jared, in the Trekmate forums, and this is going to be an audio voicemail.
Greetings, Lou and James. I've been listening to the Lou Trek Show for a while and decided to join you on the TNG adventure that is the Battle Bridge, even though TNG is at the bottom of my Star Trek ranking ladder. I listened to the first episode of the Battle Bridge a couple of days after it was released and watched Encounter at Farpoint just the other day. Yes, the podcast has, if nothing else, convinced me to rewatch TNG for the first time, barring the odd specific episode off broadcast television, or the DVD compilations they released a few years ago. It's strange that I'm more than willing to give TOS a pass thanks to the era in which it was made, but I don't feel so inclined to do the same for TNG. Maybe because I wasn't a kid when TNG premiered, so I viewed it at the same level as any other drama, and as a modern production, giving it less leeway, because it was Star Trek, rather than any other syndicated or network sci-fi show from the same era. I don't recall being overly disappointed after watching the UK premiere of TNG all those years ago, but as time passed and the show got better, it was also eclipsed by shows that came later, and my memory was painted in a more negative manner. My rewatch pretty much underlined the more negative aspects. The set design, dialogue, acting, and overall story is nothing to shout about, as a standard for Trek or sci-fi in general. There were times I was groaning or simply could not believe what I was watching, but TNG is not alone in generating that response. But I didn't feel the need to switch the episode off or go and do something else, so that's a plus. The series needs a good second installment to back up this week's premiere, and I'm not sure as I record this if I'll watch The Naked now before listening to The Battle Bridge or the other way round. Decisions, decisions. Enjoying the show, guys, and the banter between the pair of you. Mike from the UK, signing off.
And thank you for that, Mike, but as I've always said, I do believe you should watch the episode before you listen to any commentary. I do that myself. I went through half of the Gamma Quadrant podcast before I realized that why don't I watch the episode and then listen to the commentary, because sometimes when you listen to a commentary or a review of an episode, it's not as fresh and you miss a few things. And there are times that I thought that they really made some flubs, but I didn't point them out because, or I didn't know if I was right because I didn't watch the episode before. So I do recommend you do watch the episode. As far as TNG not being at the bottom of your drawer, well, I don't know. There's pros and cons to that, but for its period piece, Gene wanted it back on TV, and I think that's why we have to give it a pass. It's Star Trek. What came out after it, I think, obviously, Deep Space Nine was a whole lot better. Voyager was in more Roddenberry-esque vision of Star Trek. And then Enterprise, I'm not exactly sure why they felt the need to do Enterprise, but it wasn't anything bad, I will say. I did like Enterprise. There were some parts of it I really liked. So we'll see. We need another series, I mean. But Star Trek is Star Trek, and you gotta love it either way. But hey, Mike, thank you. Send more audio recordings anytime you want, and I hope our show gets better, because I know TNG does. We just have to suffer for a while, but then we're gonna have a huge payback coming in the third season. Thanks again, Mike.
And we have a few people that have written. Some of them are back and forth to each other, but still, we'll go ahead and read what everybody has had to say. You want to start us off, James?
Yes, sure. So the first comment that came into the forum was from Emma, so PTAC Emma, and she says that, hey, I totally agree with James that Data is the best character in Star Trek ever. So like minds think alike on that case.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the best character in Star Trek ever, does that include even Naomi Wildman?
Yes, I think it does.
You mean, 40 of Triple D, too? I mean, 7 of 9.
7 of 9 is a good character, by the way. She's good. I think that in my opinion, when they brought her in, I think that they were extremely lucky with Jerry Ryan.
Oh yeah,
to be honest, extremely lucky, because one could argue that she was brought in, because of her looks, one could argue that she's brought in because of her looks. But she's a mighty fine actor,
yes,
and she holds a lot of shows together towards the end of Voyager. So I think, you know, I doubt they were going for that. But they happen to be very lucky with who they cast there.
Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, Dr. Dammit, Jim McCoy. Best character ever? I'm not so sure. Data really hits me as the absolute best character ever. Very, very high up there. But, that's something I really got to give some time to. So, but thanks, Emma. Now, is that Paul's wife?
It is, yes.
Oh, yeah. I saw a picture of her from a couple years back. Dang, good-looking girl. But never mind. That's irrelevant. Sorry, Paul. I didn't say that. Okay.
And he's a lucky guy.
He is a lucky guy. Yes, he is. And Paul, in fact, he even wrote us, too. So, hey, Emma, give me the keyboard. I want to write something, too. Oh, they were 2 days apart. Never mind. It says, great start to the podcast, guys. Encounter at Farpoint is certainly not my TNG. Favorite TNG episode, and in my mind, probably the weakest pilot for all of the series. However, it is an interesting episode in Trek archaeology to look back on. From people I know who are old enough to remember this on first run, here I am, most say that although it was not a stunning episode, it signals something very different on TV, and it did. I think that out of all the writing styles in TNG, this one contains the most DNA from the original series. Now, keep in mind, guys, we are talking about Encounter at Farpoint Part 2.
at the time that we had recorded that, we hadn't even done The Naked Now. So how can this one contain the most DNA from the original series? I'm going to put crickets in there.
Yes. No, I see where you're, I see where you're coming from on that. But I do think that certainly the villain, right? Q is very very original series esque.
Yes.
Or at least initially he is. And I think we did make reference to to the original series, like filtering into TNG and Encounter at Farpoint. But absolutely, by the time Naked Now comes around, and it's a not quite a cut and paste script copy, but yeah, that also shares a lot of similarities with TOS.
Plus, we got a couple of years before we get Picard out of his shirt anyway, right?
Off the top of my head, I don't know when that happens. I'm trying to think.
Yeah.
Captain's Holiday?
Could be.
I suspect. Anyway.
Could be. All right, well, why don't you follow up with Mark?
Yes, so Mark replies that... said, well, I did see this during the first run, and at the time I thought it was great. But as you say, that's probably because it hit me at the right time and signified that something special was going to happen. Looking back, it isn't so great, but then I know how good TNG got later on.
Yes. Same thing. I almost lost it for the entire series in the first run because I just didn't like it for all the wrong reasons, and I'm glad I stuck on. All right, so the Android went on. Right on, Mark. Right on, brother. Didn't we all buy this hook, line, and sinker at first run? Well, I never thought about Wonderkind and Extra Weepy Troy. I'm not sure what that means either. What's the Wonderkind and Extra Weepy Troy? And thought, seriously? Fortunately, they eventually got better. Your mileage may vary on how much they improved. Now, they improve in leap years, leaps and bounds. But what's a wonder kind?
No. He means a wonder kid.
Oh, the wonder kid. Okay. Yeah. All right, droid. You gotta spell check.
It's pretty predictive text.
Well, I don't know. Maybe he had something going on there. Okay, the Captain Proton. Okay,
Yes, got a comment from Captain Proton. He said, you guys kind of snagged off the quote-unquote future humans with the silly guns and the armor that Q shows Picard and co. Well, I understand that it doesn't quite quote-unquote make sense when they shoot their guns and act scary, and it does cause continuities later in the show, but I actually kind of like that depiction of Earth's future. I don't like it because I want to live there, and maybe I just love silly 80s action movies too much, but those scenes work for me. It does effectively show how low humanity has sunk, even from the current times. And without this part of the episode, Encounter at Farpoint would sink to the ranks of hardly watchable. Anyway, good podcast, and I'll be listening next week. And actually, I do have to say that I think we were a tad harsh on that scene, and I think I was a tad harsh on that scene, I have to admit. But I accept the captain's the points there.
Yeah, Ben is perfectly on track with that. You're right, we were a little bit harsh, but I guess I just, wanted to see a blood trail from when they drug the guy's dead body away. what's wrong with the blood trail? Or, we should see bullets ricocheting off the ground and, maybe a few of the spectators could have gotten hit. You know, it does happen later on. One of the spectators does bite the bullet on another episode, so, okay, I can live with it. All right, another one from the Android. Any Q nitpicks can be explained away by saying he orchestrated everything, including his pursuit. Don't you think he can pop in on Picard anywhere in an instant and not Sonic the Hedgehog across the universe in his Q-mobile? Rapid progress. Stay where art's out. The frozen form of Lieutenant Torres. As for Riker watching repeats, I'm reminded of Kirk saying to Spock, no video documentation makes tape records in that detail that perfect. File footage, courtesy of Q. That is good. Yeah, it should have had the Q logo on the playback that Riker was watching.
Yes, and Kira Macduff follows it up by asking, did Q do the flight recorder data when Spock died as well? That footage seemed pretty good when Kirk was showing it to Sarek.
Uh-huh.
Either that or tape records got a lot better after than the menagerie.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Actually, I seem to remember, I think the worst culprit for this was Star Trek IV, when they actually show the Enterprise being blown up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And they have that at the Federation, at the Starfleet. It's either Starfleet meeting or the Federation Council meeting, but they show the exterior shot that they used in a Search for Spock.
Right.
And there clearly wouldn't have been any recorders of that actually happening.
No, there shouldn't have been. All right. All right. Well, the Admiral again says, that's Jarek, by the way, you know, I may just have to rewatch TNG to get most out of your shows. Believe me, that's the highest praise I can give to the Battle Bridge. Well, thank you, Jarek. I agree with you 100%. And like the doctor says,
everyone should be rewatching TNG.
Absolutely. And I think that's what you should do. Watch the episode and then take in the comments. And the reason why I say that is, number one, it's fresh in your brain. And number two, you've just watched it and you can point out all the parts that were wrong and let us know. I like to be told when I'm wrong. I love to, I know it sounds weird, but I like it when somebody can point out something and teach me something. I don't know everything, and you guys obviously can be my brain, so please do send us our comments. And I'll give my buddy Jason off to James.
Oh, and the final comment comes in from Jason saying, just great, Lou and James. Perfect, in fact. I meant to leave a post earlier, but had gremlins in the system. Keep up the great work. Love it already, Jason. And apparently Tori says, hi, Lou.
Oh, hi, Tori. Yes. Much love back at you, Jason. You know that. So, and let's get on with the show. The Last Outpost. And just to recap, in pursuit of Ferengi marauders, I got that word right. The Enterprise and its quarry become trapped in a mysterious planet that is draining both ships' energies. And nobody realizes it, too. Did you notice when Troy says, excuse me, sir, I realize it. This is none of my business. I'm just a woman, and I'm just sitting up here to kind of like, you know, eye candy for your first officer. But have you seen that planet out there? Because Picard's head whips around like, what? Planet? What planet? Did you get that idea?
No, absolutely. I noticed that in this episode, Troy is good. She is competent, and she's the first to mention the planet, and she actually provides, you know, throughout really the entire episode, she provides decent counsel to the captain, and also kind of, you know, puts in countering viewpoints to, you know, to Worf and to Yar when they were trying to, you know, suggest a fight and so on. So I was watching this expecting almost the Troy kind of headache show, but Troy behaves very well in this episode.
Yes. So one thing we got to get straight out of way. Let's put this to bed real quick. When TNG was filmed, it was obviously even a couple years before Quantum Leap had even begun. So obviously no one had any idea that there would be a Captain Archer, you know, heading up the Warp 5 vessel. So yes, the Ferengi had already been part of the Federation's past. But Picard does say, other than rumors, we know nothing about it. Here's what I think happened. Section 31 found out about the Ferengi in Captain Archer's time, and they suppressed the information. So obviously, rumors would have stirred, but all information about the Ferengi was excised. And now here we are, what, almost 200 years later, meeting them again. So nobody knows about them.
Well, I mean, in fairness, the Enterprise show, they didn't mention the Ferengi by name. So I think they tried very carefully not to bring up the name. Frankly, even had they brought up the name and, you know, and footage of the Ferengi and all of that, I really wouldn't put it past someone at Starfleet headquarters just to misspell their name or something and keep them misfiled. So it doesn't actually cause me that much of a, you know, internal continuity canon pain to watch this and also to accept the acquisition, the episode from Star Trek Enterprise at the same time.
Right. So now, if anybody else wants to put their thoughts in on why the Federation didn't know of the Ferengi that they dealt with a couple hundred years back, go ahead. I think that might be fun, what your suggestions might be as to why that could be. Nothing serious. Yes, I know it was a writer's gaffe. I know they screwed up. It doesn't matter. But come up with some interesting ways of why the Ferengi are new to the Federation when we already should have known about them. Make it fun, guys. Okay, so a malfunction on the Ferengi engine breaks LaForge's heart. Did you notice that? Break my heart.
I did. Actually, a couple of things I'd like to say about the teaser in particular to this episode. Mm-hmm. I actually think that the teaser works extremely well, right? So you start with them pursuing the unknown vessel. I think it builds up the mystery and the tension quite nicely.
Yeah.
When I first watched it, and I think this happens to everyone, because I think it's actually pretty well written, and it's certainly written this way, you believe that you're chasing the Ferengi, you catch the Ferengi, and you are led to believe that the Ferengi are the guys that are causing, you know, the disturbances, and they get the Enterprise, in their grips.
Yeah.
But if you actually do listen to what actually does happen, it does sound like the Ferengi flew past the planet first. They get caught first. So looking back in retrospect, you can see a lot of these not necessarily hidden details, but things that were throwaway lines that does correspond to what actually happened. But on the first watch of the show, you're kind of these things are hidden, and you're told to look elsewhere for what the actual reasons are of the events. And I quite like that. I think that was relatively good, clever writing.
Yes, because it seems like they're setting them up as a very powerful entity that we really shouldn't be messing with, because they're equal in our power, they're equal in our technology, and they do have whips. I wonder if they have chains, too. Whips and chains. Do you think what they use those whips for, other than defense? Never mind.
The whips.
And we don't see them anymore, do we? Do we see those whips again?
Well, I do know that, the one thing eventually the Ferengi become a very, very different prospect in Star Trek. And that's not just in Deep Space Nine, but even by the time by the time the Ferengi come back again, they're not the same Ferengi. But I do like it. I believe towards the end of Deep Space Nine, there's a reference to I think it's the Marauder Mo action figure with whip. And I think it's when Quark visits Ferenginar, and he has a little toy of one of these Ferengis.
That's right.
I think that's the only time that this the existence of the whips is acknowledged. But I may be wrong.
Right. Okay. So, what'd you think of the Ferengi ship design?
Oh, actually, I've got notes to this effect. I actually think it looks great.
Yeah.
I think it looks it's very nicely done. I like the design of it, but also it's beautifully lit. Mm-hmm. It has a whole load of windows, and it's got nice it's got nice light emanating from inside. I think it's clear that they've put a lot of effort into this particular design, and I think it works. I think it works great.
Yes, it is an interesting looking ship. Okay, so I don't know. It just seemed like Geordi had a little bit of apathy towards the Ferengi. Breaks my heart. I don't know. But then he does say, "Hello, stranger."
Mm-hmm.
As they both end up in orbit. So now the Enterprise begins to malfunction, and what do we hear? Immobilized by a damn Ferengi. I wonder if the Klingons really knew about the Ferengi at this point.
I'm not sure. You don't get the impression as much. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. So, somebody had to have known something, maybe even the Vulcans. You would think the Vulcans would know who the Ferengi are. It's almost like everybody in the Alpha Quadrant had no idea who these people were until then. But they're the Yankee traitors who sailed the galaxy in search of capitalism.
Yes, I think that the I mean, I think one of the failings of the initial design, I suppose, of the Ferengi is that I think they didn't quite know what they were going for, because I know that at the beginning, I mean, at least the story goes, at the beginning they were supposed to be the main villain to replace the Klingons in the Next Generation, and they were going to be a proper threat. But even at this stage, there are references to, you know, the Yankee traders and the rest of it, and you do start seeing, you know, there are features about the Ferengi that really set them up as being the equivalent of 20th century humans, or even maybe 19th century humans. So you have the, you know, you have them representing, you know, quote unquote, the worst aspects of capitalism, and even other things like, I mean, Troy mentions that they can't read their mind, so it's implied that they're, it's almost literally they are quote unquote closed-minded. That and they, you know, they don't allow the females to wear clothes and stuff. To me, it seems like they're really being positioned as being a reflection of humans. And I'm not sure how easy it is to have that kind of a background and to have them also as a big alien threat at the same time. And I think that's something that it never, to me, it never quite felt right that someone that would be interested in trade would somehow be also a threat on, you know, on par with the, you know, the Romulans or the Klingons or something like that.
Sure. What do you think of their? I don't know what they hit them with, some kind of phaser, or what do you think of their phaser array or their, the way they fired? It's like something came out of what could be their deflector dish, and you just see this ring of fire coming at the ship.
Yeah. No. Yeah. All cool, and you know, you don't get. It's nice to have a bit of variation from just your standard, you know, your standard phasers, or, you know, when you have a bird of prey, it's very clear where the you know, the stuff is coming from. So I think it's all cool.
Right, and what it seemed like is that burst from the dish was just to get your attention while they actually fire the photon torpedo at them, because it looks like they had two things that come out of their ship. First, the blue round of fire, and then a little ball of white came at them. So it's like, I don't know, and then dissolves. So, okay, now let's go on back to LaForge and Riker. They end up in engineering, where LaForge is explaining how we push and they push back with equal force. Curious question.
And did you notice this is, I suppose, the first time LaForge ends up in engineering, fundamentally doing the chief engineer's role, because she must be sick today.
Right. So my question was, as you put it on the last one, where's the drop-in engineer for the week?
Indeed.
You know, it's no wonder why Geordi got promoted so fast. But then again, he did come up with an idea that didn't work. What was the idea? Shift down, then kick into warp 9, come back biting. Woo-wee! Oh, I think, you know, that's a little unprofessional. Woo-wee.
Woo-wee, indeed. You need the woo-wee, otherwise the plan doesn't work.
Yes, right.
Which is what went wrong.
So when it didn't work, what sound does that make?
Wah, wah.
That's good. Wah, wah. And a T9 energy converter. That could use some more explanation. And since they didn't, maybe we need to come up with the... What is a T9 energy converter?
Well, it's the one ahead of the T8, which was the best energy converter of that of the previous year. So, you know, these are things that you really can't let fall into enemy hands, or replicate a new one or anything like that. You really have to chase down the guy that stole it from an unmanned outpost.
Oh. Could they just come up with the T10? Or the T9D?
T10s are too expensive.
Oh. T9 Bravo? I don't know. T9 and a half? So, okay. Well, anyway, so we're going to shift down on the count of three. Step one, set warp to 9. Step two, divert shield power to main engines. Step three, shake, rattle, but no roll. Nope, didn't work. LaForge, you suck. I'm just kidding. That's probably what Picard was thinking. You will never be promoted on my ship.
I mean, did we not get, I mean, rolling a little bit ahead, but we've got pretty much the same situation, right? With this event in a couple of seasons, I believe. They did get stuck again, and I think that they used something similar to get out of, you know, rocking yourself out of an energy field drain.
But you know what was weird about this one? As they were putting the plan into motion, hitting warp 9, you know how normally when there's a rocking of the ship, they just rock the camera? They didn't rock the camera this time. They just put it out of focus.
No, I don't know why that would be. Maybe that's just getting used to the methods and whatnot. Actually, something that you do find with these with the early episodes, I think, in particular, and you know, looking back of the couple that we've seen so far, is that I think the directors have much more of influence over how things are shot.
Well, yeah.
So I think by the time you get into the third and fourth season, things get very. There's a pattern that is followed. There's a way of dealing things that kind of works, quote unquote. Whereas you can see a lot of experimental stuff going on from Encounter at Farpoint all the way through to this episode. So maybe it's them trying to settle down into a good style to put across the information.
Well, I wonder if I could even do that. You know, they start jerking the camera and I got to shake back and forth. We all got to shake in the same way. And I wonder if we could do it. I don't know. You want to try, James?
Sure.
Let's shake. Let's go photon torpedo in 3, 2, 1. Boom.
Boom.
Oh, wait. Which way did you go? I didn't see you. Never mind.
I went backwards.
Oh, backwards. You went backwards. See, now I went to the left and forward. So, no, we forget it. We can't do this. Okay, so now somebody is reading every file into ship's memory bank, including what everyone gets paid, how much sick time they have left, their marital status, number of children, money in their bank accounts, status of their virginity. Oh, by the way, there's only one on board who's got it still. Can you care to guess who?
Well, since a couple of weeks ago, it's not Data.
Not
that's
Data.
For sure.
It's funny. They think the Ferengi are doing this until Troy finally brings up the most critical piece of the puzzle, the planet. Conference! Conference.
Although, immediately after it's brought up that it's the planet, they do ignore her.
Right.
They don't say, yes, let's have a look at the planet. They say, yes, let's call a conference, and then they end up saying, we're going to have a chat to the Ferengi because we're stuck. Mm-hmm.
Yes, we are. We're screwed. So, you know, Troy brings up a good point, you know, since we've tried to talk to them, but have we said anything that they want to hear? So Picard strolls back onto the bridge to put his excellent plan into motion. You know, beg to not hurt me. Don't hurt me, please. We surrender. Again! Oh, he didn't really say surrender, but, you know, what are your terms? Do they surrender that much, really?
Well, actually, I noticed this as well. This is episode 4, if you count Encounter at Farpoint as one episode. Uh-huh. And Picard has already surrendered twice.
Yes.
And I don't know, but I don't think Kirk surrendered at all during the original run.
No. He started self-destruct, but not surrender.
Yeah, I don't think he did surrender at all. I don't think he surrendered until he didn't surrender until Undiscovered Country, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe I'm wrong.
Correct, and that was just to get on board the Gorkon ship.
Yeah, but now we've got the new captain and, you know, the new bold crew, and episode four surrendered twice, so we've got a surrender rate of 1 in 2.
Right, it's not a good thing. So
no.
All right, Jean-Luc, let's get a little tougher. So Yar and Worf seriously want to take a bite out of the Ferengi, but then the Ferengi decide to communicate and talk about the terms of surrender. And their terms are, no terms. The Ferengi will never surrender. To which Picard does a humbada, 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 huh? And he does the, the kill gesture. Wait, what's going on here?
No, and actually, I have to say that the first time I watched this, I was surprised. I was surprised that this is the way that the episode went. I know that Troy does bring up the planet a little bit in advance, but I think, you know, you're encouraged to let that go. There are a lot of references to be caught by the Ferengi. They have us where they want us and all sorts. And I was buying it. But the clever thing is that you buy it the first time you watch the episode. Mm-hmm. But the second time you watch the episode, you see that they have put in the little, the little bits of information if you choose to, to look. And, first the ship falling out of warp, first the Ferengi ship falling out of warp, and Troy bringing things up. And I actually quite like how this, so far at this point, I'm enjoying the episode, and I think it's working pretty well.
Yes, because you thought the Ferengi had them, and then finds out that that's not true. It's actually the planet. It's got both of them. So, okay. So, but basically, they're in the same boat we are, so let's launch a probe and see who it is that's got us. And can we see the view of the other ship, to which the ugliness of the human is not an exaggeration indeed.
Now, what's your opinion of the makeup, the Ferengi makeup?
Do you notice a tattoo on...
On the head, yes.
Yes. It seemed like the shape of his ship.
It's the shape of the marking, right? The Ferengi... It's the Ferengi alphabet or something. It comes up a lot. You'll see those markings on the ship. You'll see the markings around Quark's bar as well. It's almost either their insignia or possibly even the language, the alphabet that they use. And I actually quite like the tattoos.
Yeah. Well, my thoughts of the Ferengi are they were pathetic, actually. I'm so glad they change throughout the series, and especially into DS9. But the idea of these scouring with their hands up in the air, bunch of buffoons is what I got.
Yes, that's true. But at this point still in the episode where you're just communicating over the,
true.
The view screen. I'm still with it. I'm thinking the Ferengi guys and the makeup it's substantial. So that's at least something. They don't look like other aliens that have come so far. It seems to be reasonably well done. Once you get down onto the planet, though, as I mentioned before, it really is a bit of a two halves kind of episode. The monkey like behavior on the planet is really what kills the episode, I'm afraid.
Right. So I guess if we were to figure out what the B storyline is, and that's one of the things that Gamma Quadrant always talked about, was what's the A story and the B story. So do you think the portal is the B story?
I don't think we get B stories in early TNG.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Because it's something that I noticed, and here's a tangent, something that I noticed when I was rewatching. When you get into season 2, you start getting B stories.
Right.
So you start getting slightly more sophisticated, slightly cleverer writing. And we're still in the age where, scene by scene by scene by scene, it refers to the same thing going on. It's the same story.
Yeah.
There was a slight B story in Encounter at Farpoint, but that's really because it was such a significant episode.
Right.
But I don't think we get B stories. I mean, we'll see as the weeks go by.
Yeah.
But I think that it's really into season 2 when things get a little bit a little more sophisticated.
Yeah, I think the most significant example of like a story, B story would be Data's Day.
Oh, yes, indeed.
So that's kind of what we'll get into as far as A and B. Okay. So let's see. Where was I in my notes here?
Did you find it strange that a race of traders didn't understand what a swap was?
Right.
That seemed a little peculiar, right? Although, perhaps in fairness, they're speaking through the universal translator and things don't quite match up in terms of translation.
Sure.
But it can't be a new concept to anyone that's traded a swap, especially when they use the, especially when to explain the swap, they say, a trade.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so they're going to give the life of their second officer for his failure. Did you see Data? Oh, it's a good thing the Federation doesn't do that.
And actually, Data's bad in this episode. For he does that at least three times. He sits at the front of the bridge and he talks like a small child through a cinema screening.
Right.
He does it here. He does it with Worf a couple of times as well. And in one case, he gets overheard by the Ferengi on the view screen as well.
Yes. Yeah, Yankee traitor.
Yeah, explain, Yankee traitor.
I'm surprised we're in here, Mr. Data. Please do not do that when I'm talking. And then the Chinese finger puzzle.
Oh, the finger puzzle.
That was a B story. The finger
that
puzzle.
That was the B story. That was the B story. You're right.
Send him a box of finger puzzles.
Yeah. At A story is that, you know, Picard has to save the ship by not forcing his way out of an energy trap. B story is that Data has to get out of a finger puzzle without forcing his way out of that. I mean, in a way, it's a symmetric, good storytelling narrative there.
Okay. It's interesting. You know, and here's one thing. Data says that the image of the Ferengi was distorted, and Troy knows that Daemon Tar is hiding something. She can't read them. How does she know he's hiding something?
Yeah, and I didn't quite get the idea. Why was it distorted, the image? I didn't quite understand what he was referring to.
I didn't think it was.
It just looked, I mean, it was blown up, and he was standing in front of a white screen, but distorted. I never quite understood what he was referring to, whether, you know, how that worked.
I didn't think so either. Okay, so anyway, they finally decide to beam down to the planet. Maybe figure out what's going on. You know, maybe have a powwow. Riker, Yar, Data, LaForge, and Worf beam down, and they find out it's a one-way mission. Now, some of the things that LaForge did, actually, if we had to pick the character I liked in the episode, I think today would be LaForge. You know, my hero type thing. Or, you know, they're briefing on the way into the transporter room, and oh, by the way, there isn't enough power to beam back, to which LaForge says, oh,
yeah, you have to ask.
You had to ask.
No, I agree with you. I think LaForge does well. And actually, what I think this episode is I think this is the first time we get into specific roles or the roles of the characters that then later we know them for. So if you think about LaForge, he's kind of like, he's solving the problem. He's the techie guy. I mean, Data's there to help, and there's a slight bit of humor at his expense and so on. Picard's doing his diplomatic stuff, commanding the bridge, whilst Riker's taking the away mission. Worf and also to an extent Yar, they're doing, you know, they're putting across the security message, trying to be aggressive and making sure that everything is covered. And I think that's really the first time we see it work in this well. I think in previous episodes, it you know, for one reason or another, they didn't have these well-defined roles. Whereas now I think, you know, certainly people like Geordi and Data and Riker are coming into the role in which they're going to be associated for the next 7 years.
Right. Got it. Okay. Well, so they beam down and we find that it looks like Riker is alone. But later he finds Data checking out a crystal formation that's nothing to write home about. And they look a little bit further and they find the Forge just hanging around.
Yeah, how lucky was LaForge to be beamed into that position rather than, like, just slightly over to one side when his leg would have been completely covered in rock or something?
Yeah, it is fascinating. But, you know, I mean, they can get him down. All it takes is one whip of the Ferengi prophet whip, and boom, they knock him all out. But if he moves, kill him. That was Quark, I hear, wasn't it?
Yes, Quark's the main.
Yeah.
He's the main, well, not Quark, but the actor who played Quark plays the main guy that's on the down on the planet. And yes, and as mentioned before, this is really the bit where the Ferengi start now acting. I think any suggestion that they're going to be a threat going forward, or they're going to be somehow mysterious or a villain to fear, goes out of the window with the kind of performance that these three guys put on for the last, I think 15 minutes or so of the show.
The clothed female, sickening. I don't know, what part of Yard do you find sickening? I mean, so if she didn't have her clothes on, would that be okay with them? It'd be okay with me, but it would be okay with them?
I think so, yeah. I think that's the main thing.
Then I agree with the Ferengi. That was sickening. Now, the Ferengi whips, I call them the prophet whips, and the phasers don't work. The crystalline tree shapes are just taking the energy. So that's what's at least what Geordi's visor is picking up on what's going on. But then just in time for a being to appear. It seemed like after a few seconds of intense intimidation, the guy reminds me of the Wizard of Oz. He comes out from behind the curtain and says, I'm not really a bad guy. I'm a good wizard.
No, and did anyone else get a flashback to God from Star Trek V with the first couple of seconds of very loud and intimidating voice?
Loud and
vocal. When I was watching, I think that the Ferengi human interaction on the planet's not good, and then when Porto appears. Unfortunately, it just gets worse. In my opinion, it just gets worse if that's even possible.
Right. Well, the Ferengi accuse the humans of withholding information and misusing gold, and much, much, much worse is that they clothe their female. So, what is this one little? I don't want to say fat Ferengi, but he looks a little chunky. He starts flirting with Lieutenant Yar, so what does she do? Did you see that little kick?
What, kicks him away?
Yeah, she kind of like throws her foot up in the air.
and actually, I did notice this time that, I mean, the Ferengi are specifically behaving. I mean, these guys aren't that short. They are hunched down. They are trying to be as short as possible, except when they come up with their arms and trying to behave trying to scare the people off. But they're facing off against obviously Riker, Worf, and Yar, who are all quite tall guys, right?
Right.
Guys and girls. So I think that they really are, you know, everything is set up to portray the Ferengi as these horrendous monkey-like creatures, and that's to me, it doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
And actually, I've mentioned this before, and maybe it will come up again. But at this point, when you know the behavior that they show towards Yar, and you know, Yar slightly tries to kick one of them, and they run away, and all of that. I mean, at this point, the Ferengi are on my list of how did these people end up with warp drive kind of scenarios. You don't see this behavior and expect them to have been able to build a ship and pilot a ship.
Yeah. And Riker actually does mention that, you know, he sees them as humans were hundreds of years ago, but obviously they have the technology they shouldn't have at their stage of evolution.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
So anyway, it looks like the portal probes Riker's mind, and he seems to like what he sees. So I guess Riker may have just made a new BFF, huh?
Yes. And I think following on from Code of Honor from last week, which is that there's a lot of high moral navel gazing going on, right? How we're superior to this species. I think we then touch that on that again, where Portal and Riker are talking about just how great and evolved humans are, and how they follow some ancient Chinese philosophy that is similar to Portal's, and how the Ferengis are not, and and Riker mentions, perhaps one day they'll learn, and then, oh, well, what if they don't learn? So, well, our morals suggest that we have to take that risk. And I mean, really, the scenes with Portal and Riker and speaking about how morally superior humans are, and how fundamentally childlike the Ferengi are, in my opinion, this kind of behavior, it just completely kills the notion of the Ferengi now in any way being a threat.
Right.
Because they do get relegated into childlike race. And yeah, you can, you can give a child a gun, but is he really going to be a threat? I mean, you can do a bit of, you can have an accident or two.
Right.
But you can't, you can't place these people on the same level as the Romulans with their, devious conniving, or the Klingons with their brutality, or the Kardashians to come. These are just guys that are immature, but they might have something dangerous. And I can't see that as a, you know, as a significant threat going forward.
No, nope, but then we'll even see a race that's worse later. So, okay. So
are you talking about the Packlets?
I'm talking about the Packlets. Yeah, they're even worse than the Ferengi.
I don't know, it's a close run thing.
Yeah, very close. So the portal just offers to destroy the Ferengi, but Riker says they would learn nothing, you know. But, you know, an interesting question. Was the portal offering to just destroy the three Ferengi on the planet, or all of Ferengi? How much power do you think he may have had?
I always interpret it as being the Ferengi on... Oh, when you say all of the Ferengi, do you mean the ship plus the guys, or the entire race?
You're right. I suppose the three on the planet and the ship. I think he obviously could have destroyed the ship at any time. But yeah, I don't see godlike powers to destroy the entire race.
And I actually sometimes, I mean, I get quite uncomfortable about the idea that there's, you know, a relatively large number of godlike aliens out there that, if they happen to wake up on the wrong side of the bed, could start wiping out entire civilizations.
Yeah.
The reason why is that you always have to put a check in against why they're not going to do that. So if you do have, you know, when you have a godlike person, you can't go up against a godlike person because the godlike person wins.
Yeah.
It's just as simple as that.
I was going to say the Husnock tried to go up against the Daud, and we see how that goes later. You know, all Husnock, all of them everywhere. You know, he wipes them all out. Okay, so anyway, it's now time to go back to sleep for the portal, who barely makes it to bed. He looks like he's about to fall over. All the power's back on the ship, by the way.
Actually, can I say one thing about the ship?
Yeah.
I am a big fan of the models that they used and the techniques that they used in order to get the ships. And you can tell that they spent a lot of money getting the models right, getting the internal lights on and things like that. But one benefit you have is that when these ships are powered down, you get to see the ships without the lights on. And I think they look really nice without the lights, and they look really nice with the lights.
Yes.
And I think it's something that, with the move towards CGI, you kind of lose. You know, the reason why they look nice without the lights is because they're fundamentally a model that doesn't have lights on. And the reason why they look good with the light is because they're fundamentally a model that has lights on. And the lighting works very nicely.
Yeah.
So I have to say, watching this, it doesn't look like 25-year-old work or anything.
No, it doesn't.
It looks great. For the it looks great effects, and you know I think you'd be hard pressed to get something this good these days. Probably not because they can't do it, but it probably takes a lot of money to get CGI imagery looking as good as these models were done under the under the lighting and the shots that they took.
I suppose, you know, a couple questions I still do have about when the computer comes back online. Or the ship powers back up, it just seems like instantly everybody kind of wakes up. I mean, do you think it heats up automatically, or obviously the ship doesn't have to light the pilot light and then wait for the blower and then push the heat out? It's almost like they're just okay instantly.
No, you're right there. You're right. And in fact, I had an issue with the why was it getting cold? I didn't quite understand why it was getting cold.
Well, the engines were offline. I thought it was the heat of the engine core that actually helped heat the ship up.
Okay. I hear where you're coming from. And I'm actually tempted to have a section of, you know, scientific inaccuracy of the week.
Yeah.
But I'll put it to you, if you did have heat in the ship, mm-hmm. where does the heat go? Because it doesn't disperse into space.
No.
Not fast in any case. The only way you can lose heat in a ship is through radiation, and you're not going to lose that type of heat that quickly. If you think about what you have in houses, you have double glazing and stuff. What the thing that prevents you losing the heat is the vacuum, and you've got a ship here that's in the vacuum of space. You're not going to radiate heat that much. So get a couple of guys together in a warm room, you'll probably be fine for the first couple of months, at least.
Yeah. Well, then again, how did Apollo 13 lose its heat?
I'm I'm not convinced that it did.
Oh! We may have to find Lovell. Is he still alive?
Oh, he is, indeed.
He's dead?
No, he's alive.
Oh, maybe we have to find him and ask him that question. Yeah, well, some people think that we never made it to the moon either. That's the United States, not England.
No, we didn't get to the moon.
No, the Queen never decided to go. She just didn't want to go. We all know she could if she really put her mind to it. Oh, and my second question. Let's go back a little bit. Beverly says that she was tempted to give Wesley a hypo spray or something. That pretty much tells me that she knocked him out. Do you think that she did, or she was about to, or because he says, you know, he deserves to face death on his feet or something?
Yeah, actually, I hope I'm never placed in a position where you have to make that call for your own kids.
Yeah,
but I don't think it's the right call to make. Right? He said, "Well, I've got a kid." I mean, Wesley's not in this episode, so I suppose that might have played into it. But I don't think you take a kid and, you know, knock the guy out and just let them, let them not wake up.
Right.
So I was with Picard on that side.
Yeah, obviously, yeah. That sounds about right. Okay, so in the end, we got our T9 energy converter back, so we don't have to file bankruptcy.
Yeah, there are two more repayments still on that energy converter.
Absolutely. And late payments and late fees on the converter is phenomenal. So, but Riker wants to send the Ferengi a present. A box of the Chinese finger puzzles. Make it so.
Now, I noticed that it was referenced that this was supposed to be a nod towards the trouble with Tribbles when they send over the Tribbles to the Klingon to the Klingon ship.
Yeah,
and it's not on the same level.
No,
right? It really isn't. If this is what they think a nod towards that episode is, they should just move along and not do it.
No, I think one of the stage crew had this Chinese finger puzzle in his pocket, and someone looked and said, "Oh, wouldn't that be funny if we get, you know, that on Data's fingers?" And that's probably how that came about. Nobody actually thought that in the writing plan. I doubt it.
My instinct is slightly different because I think that you can actually read a bit more into the Ferengi here. I think that giving you a clue. I think someone on the writing staff had investment in the company that made those little Chinese finger puzzles.
Oh.
And he thought, let's get it out there and shown to however many people are going to be watching this episode for the foreseeable future.
Okay. Well, then, if you have anything more, I thought, you know, we can go on to our final thoughts and ratings.
One final thing, and it is my favorite quote of the episode, and it comes from one of the Ferengi down on the planet, so it can't be all bad. But it's when he said, "They are demented. Their values are insane. You cannot believe the business opportunities they have destroyed." Something, for whatever reason, that tickles me inside.
Yeah.
Actually, mainly probably because I can imagine some people saying that and meaning it.
Right.
So that tickles me. And it is, you know, it is worth noting that we even from the first episode, we have the certain grain of, what will eventually become, the foundations for the rules of acquisition, their desire for profit and business. It is here. It is all here. It's not particularly nicely wrapped up or handled well, but it is here.
Okay.
It's now time to give a rating for this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. And I think I'm going to give this one and this is a hard decision, unfortunately. I'm very much on the fence. I think that the first half, and it's almost exactly the first half, I'm liking this episode a lot, and I think this is coming in at a 4 because it works well, and there is this mystery, and you've got, you're pushed to one side thinking it's the Ferengi, and then it turns and I think it's clever, and then you get down to the planet and it just collapses. So the first half is like a 4 and the last half is like a 1, and I think that it's somewhere between a 2 and a 3, but I don't know whether or not I'm going to be generous and say it's a 3 or whether I'm going to be nasty and say it's a 2. It's a 3. It's not as bad as a 2. It's a 3. All in all, it's a 3.
Okay. Well, on a scale of 1 to 5, I was figuring the 1 would be the Ferengi, or no, I'm sorry, 1 will be the portal, and 5 could be the god of Shakari. yeah, I'm with you on that. First part was very good. The chase scene all the way up to the planet was a good 4, I'd say. And a good 1 for the rest of the story. However, 4 plus 1 is 5, divided by 2 comes to 2.5. So I'm going to go ahead and give it a 2.
I think between us, that's fair. Right?
Yeah, I think a 2 would be good enough. My final thoughts are, I like LaForge in this one. He's funny. My hero. Hanging upside down and so on, you know, something to write home about. No doubt my appreciation for Geordi is large, as I am, but here he's a lot of fun. First introduction to the Ferengi is nothing like our future life with them or working with them side by side. So that was bad. The all-powerful portal who sleeps on the job, is that the cause of his empire's destruction, maybe? You know, is he that clueless? Is he a sleeping species, or, you know, just does he have that strange sleeping disease, you know, narco-sleepy? When the portal was offering to destroy the Ferengi, you know, like I said, could he have destroyed them all, like the Daud, or just the ones on the ship? So, and another thing, my final thought was, I actually kind of thought, looking back on this, that the portal may be the Q taking an interest in Riker, but he just never came out as the Q.
Yep, maybe.
Okay, so any other final thoughts for you?
No. I think I've covered everything.
Next time on Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Captain, we're passing warp 5.
A warp speed malfunction hurls the Enterprise to the far reaches of space.
Data, what distance have we traveled?
2,700,000 light years, sir.
To a galaxy where the crew's thoughts.
This can't be. You've been
dead.
Become reality. It's a spellbinding journey where none have gone before on the next exciting episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation.
All right, so join us next week for Season 1, Episode 6, Where No One Has Gone Before. And we're going to have a guest like we haven't before. Want to tell them about that, James?
Hopefully that Mark Stamper from the TrekMate podcast, and also currently doing his the show with his wife, Tomb to Beam Up, an original series episode review podcast, will be joining us this time next week.
All right, and he wants to discuss Where No One Has Gone Before. I really wanted to get him on for the Naked Nell, you know, but it didn't work out. So, guys, next week, we may have a little bit of a longer show than we normally would, because I do want Mark's thoughts on the Naked Nell as it compares to the Naked Time. So look forward to that. That will be in a iPod near you coming next week. And, of course, we will have more comments on previous shows, such as The Naked Now and Code of Honor. I'm Lou from Omaha.
And I'm James from London. And good night, everybody.